under the previous administration, we looked like fools. Not anymore.
Oh. Hi, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth from just last Friday. Y'all don't look like fools at all.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
It ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yeah, hi. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A., also in California in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI and Round Mountains KKRN, up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, Eugene's KEPW, Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, got some news out of Pennsylvania today. Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, and Columbus, Ohio's WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Richmond, Virginia's WRWK, Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day for your listening convenience on the internet, on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites. Blanketing Planet Earth, I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me, from bradblog.com, now in our 22nd year of troublemaking and muckraking, thanks to you and your support. All right, busy show today for a change, including some elections and voting news. Well, there's that, at least for Democrats, some very good news in that regard today. We will get there in a bit to our friends in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, listening on WNUZ, W News. We'll get there in a bit, but first we've got to start here again today as this news continues to roil D.C., the corporate media, and yes, the Trump White House. Whether they continue to try, at least, to downplay it or not, it is and continues to be a very serious matter, and they know it, on several fronts, particularly regarding what it likely tells us about a whole bunch of stuff going on by the lawless Trump administration that we don't actually yet know about. Since The Atlantic's editor-in-chief, Atlantic Magazine's editor-in-chief, Jeffrey Goldberg, published his story on Monday detailing how he had been invited for some reason into a group chat with top-level national security and defense officials, including the Secretary of Defense, Secretary of State, Director of National Intelligence, National Security Advisor, Vice President of the United States, and others, on the unsecured, commercially available mobile phone app called Signal, the White House and former Fox News host turned Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, cited by Goldberg for sharing specific U.S. attack plans with the unsecured group. They've all been attempting to downplay the matter, claiming that while it may have been a mistake by National Security Advisor Mike Waltz to invite Jeff Goldberg into the chat, there was no classified information that was shared. So really, no harm, no foul. Why worry? In fact, whether the information was actually classified or not, in truth, you should know, doesn't actually matter, at least when it comes to the Espionage Act, which makes it a crime to even accidentally share national defense information, whether it's classified or not, with people who are not supposed to have it, like, let's say, a journalist. if it's caused by gross negligence, that, which is a best case scenario, this arguably was, that makes it unlawful under the Espionage Act. It's also a violation of the Presidential Records Act and Federal Records Act to destroy such records as the planning of a military attack. As many of the notes in the thread were set specifically by Mike Waltz to disappear after a week or, in some cases, 4 weeks. All of that, pretty textbook cases of violations of federal laws by a whole bunch of people, though not Jeffrey Goldberg. In that group chat discussing the U.S.'s imminent bombing at the time, a week or so ago, of targets in Yemen, and then the celebration of the successful bombing of those targets. But on the point of Pete Hegseth's claim that war plans were not shared via text, that's what he claimed straight out, and that the White House claims that there was nothing classified in that thread, well, when Jeffrey Goldberg published his initial story, he explained that he withheld certain texts from the thread because clearly they included likely classified national defense information, including imminent U.S. attack plans. He noted that posts to the Signal Group chat, quote, contained operational details of forthcoming strikes on Yemen, including information about targets, weapons the U.S. would be deploying, and attack sequencing. Now, Hegseth responded by calling Goldberg basically a hack journalist and claiming that none of this actually happened.
Nobody was texting war plans, and that's all I have to say about that.
Yeah, I guess that's all you have to say about that, Pete. Hegseth has since then refused to comment on any of this and on the fact that the White House confirmed, in fact, that the group text actually did, as reported by Goldberg, actually happen. And yeah, it did include war plans. Hegseth has also refused to say whether the information shared was classified or not, even as top White House officials, including Donald Trump, continue to claim on Tuesday that nothing in the thread was classified. So on Wednesday, it looks like The Atlantic decided to, well, I guess, take the White House at their word. Nothing was classified, so
they
why not publish
bluff.
It?
Yeah. Yeah, they called their bluff.
On Wednesday, The Atlantic released the entire Signal chat among senior national security officials, showing that Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, in fact, provided the exact timings of warplane launches and when bombs would drop before the men and women flying those attacks against Yemen's Houthis this month on behalf of the U.S. were even airborne. He put the information out about when the attack was going to happen, how it was going to happen, what, you know, the planes that were going to be used before the men and women actually got up in the air to do it. That seems dangerous. Especially when there's some guy from a magazine that nobody even appears to know is actually there in that thread. Whether it was classified or not, the Associated Press observes, what was revealed was jaw-dropping in its specificity, just as Goldberg reported on Monday, and includes the type of information that is kept to a very close hold to protect the operational security of a military strike. In the group chat, Hegseth posted multiple details about the impending strike using military language and laying out when a, quote, strike window starts, where a, quote, target terrorist was located, the time elements around the attack, and when various weapons and aircraft would be used in that strike. Now, while Whiskey Pete, as our friend national security journalist Marcy Wheeler calls him, who we interviewed her yesterday on this show, he can try to claim that he did not officially classify any of this information, therefore it's not classified. Well, but it will be much harder to argue that it was not national defense information, the grossly negligent sharing of which would in fact trigger a violation of the Espionage Section F that many people have in fact been charged with violating over the years. So, according to the full transcript published Wednesday by The Atlantic, quote, Godspeed to our warriors, Hegseth wrote. 12:15 Eastern Time, F-18s launch first strike package. 13:45, trigger-based F-18s first strike window starts. Target terrorist is at his known location, so should be on time. Also, strike drones launch, MQ-9s. 14:10, more F-18s launch, second strike package. 4:15, strike drones on target. Now, in all caps, this is when the first bombs will definitely drop, wrote Pete Hegseth in this unsecured text thread. Pending earlier trigger-based targets. 15:36, F-18's second strike starts. Also, first sea-based Tomahawks launched. More to follow per timeline. We are currently clean on OPSEC, which is stands for operational security, meaning no one knows about this stuff except for the journalist we just told it to. A strike package includes the personnel and weapons used in an attack, including Navy F-18 fighter aircraft, MQ-9s or armed drones, Tomahawks or ship-launched cruise missiles. You get the idea. But boy, I mean, if that doesn't sound like war plans via text, I don't know what does. It also sounds a whole lot like national defense information, whether it was classified or not. And if it wasn't, it seems like it certainly should have been, since an adversary receiving that message could certainly have used it to defend targets or otherwise harm Americans involved in the attack. In the very specific details that Pete Hegseth was sharing for some reason. Now, Jeffrey Goldberg has said he asked the White House if it opposed publication of that material, and the White House responded that it would prefer that he did not publish. But they did not tell him not to do so, and frankly, good for Goldberg, who has, by the way, has been an unskeptical neocon pro-war journalist in the past on other matters, but good for him for doing so in this case. Signal is a publicly available app that provides encrypted communications, but as the Pentagon warned all employees in an official memorandum just one day before this attack against Yemen, that app can in fact be hacked, and it is not approved for carrying classified or even unclassified non-public information, which this certainly was. In February last month, the NSA warned that the Signal app was actively being used by Russian hacker groups who could exploit the app to follow along on group conversations exactly like the one that Goldberg was apparently accidentally invited into by Mike Waltz, Donald Trump's national security advisor. In an op-ed following the publication of Goldberg's initial article, the far right-wing National Review's executive editor ripped the Trump administration for this, called for accountability for what he described as, quote, extraordinarily foolish actions by officials, quote, unbecoming of their offices. Quote, the fact that these conversations happened outside of official government communications channels at all is a scandal in itself. It's a total breach of protocol and operational security, he said. In my view, wrote the National Review's Mark Antonio Wright, the most egregious behavior was Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth's. The stupidest was National Security Advisor Mike Waltz, adding Goldberg to the conversation in the first place. Wright further stressed that the Trump administration has lost all credibility in criticizing, quote, the past, present, and future mishandling of sensitive American national security information, including Hillary Clinton's past use of a private email server while serving as Secretary of State. New York Times' conservative columnist David French also called on Hegseth to resign, as our guest yesterday, Marcy Wheeler, did as well, along with calling for Trump's entire national security team to, quote, resign in disgrace, with David French stressing that such, quote, incompetence and carelessness with security information is what gets people killed. Quote, he's just blown his credibility as a military leader, wrote French about Pete Hegseth, though. Did Hegseth, who has been accused of abusing women and grotesque public drunkenness, ever actually have any credibility as a military leader to begin with? Seems like that's a stretch, Mr. French. He continued, quote, there is not an officer alive whose career would survive a security breach like that. It would normally result in instant consequences, relief from command, for example, followed by a comprehensive investigation and potentially criminal charges, writes French correctly. Several Democrats have also called for Hegseth's and Waltz's resignation, with former Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg calling it, quote, the highest level of screw up, though he used another word, imaginable. And DNC Chair Ken Martin stating, quote, Hegseth should resign, and if he doesn't resign, he should be fired. Quote, Hegseth never should have been tapped for this job. It's too important, said Senator Tammy Duckworth, Democrat of Illinois, of the former Fox News weekend host. On Tuesday, Trump expressed a different view, however. The man who became famous for pretending to fire people, telling NBC News that the leak was just a, quote, glitch, just a glitch, and that Waltz, who allegedly added Goldberg to the group chat, quote, has learned a lesson, and he's a good man. So leave him alone, in other words. Of course, as David French said, no other rank-and-file military officer would ever be accorded such velvet-glove treatment for making such a massive screw-up. Even while Republicans were attempting to downplay the issue on Monday and again on Tuesday, the situation did not appear to improve. Following a previously scheduled hearing in the U.S. Senate Intelligence Committee on Tuesday, where Trump's CIA Director John Ratcliffe and Trump's Director of National Intelligence, Tulsi Play-Dumb-Gabbard, who were both included in that Signal group chat, they attempted to fend off queries from the committee's Democrats on Tuesday.
Director Gabbard, were you overseas during any parts of these discussions?
Yes, Senator, I was.
Were you using your private phone or a public phone for the Signal discussions?
I won't speak to this because it's under review by the National Security Council. Once that review is complete, I'm sure we'll share the results with the committee.
What is under review? It's a very simple question. Are you your private phone or an officially issued phone? What could be under review?
National Security Council is reviewing all aspects of how this came to be.
Director Ratcliffe, this was a huge mistake, correct?
No.
A national political...
Hold on.
No, no, you
Let
hold
me answer.
On. No, no, Director Ratcliffe, I asked you a yes or no question, and now you hold on. A national political reporter
you can characterize
privy,
it how you want.
Was made privy
the White
to
House
sensitive information about imminent military operations
mistake,
against a foreign terrorist
an
organization.
Mistake of adding a reporter
and that wasn't a huge mistake?
A
that wasn't a huge mistake?
Well, I think they characterized it as
an embarrassment. This is utterly unprofessional. There's been no apology. There has been no recognition of the gravity of this error.
Did you know that the president's Middle East advisor was in Moscow on this thread while you were, as director of the CIA, participating in this thread? Were you aware of that? Are you aware of that today?
I'm not aware of that
this
today.
This sloppiness, this incompetence, this disrespect for our intelligence agencies and the personnel who work for them is entirely unacceptable. It's an embarrassment.
An embarrassment indeed. That was Senators Jack Reed, I believe, of Rhode Island, John Ossoff of Georgia, and Michael Bennett of Colorado questioning Donald Trump's Director of National Security and the Director of CIA. Well, things seem to have gone downhill since then. According to The Hill today, Republican senators are now calling for the Trump administration and congressional committees to officially investigate the disclosure of sensitive national security information over Signal. Not because, by the way, not because they're worried about accidentally, you know, inviting a journalist into top-level war planning conversations, or because it was done over a non-secure, commercially available and hackable mobile phone app, or that it was in violation of several federal laws and suggests that the Trump administration is unlawfully doing the very same thing, having conversations over Signal, over all kinds of things right now in order to avoid laws concerning the retention of federal records that are owned by the United States of America. Not for any of those reasons, but because they fear, as The Hill reports, the controversy could have major political consequences. And of course, it certainly should have major political consequences at the very least. Senate Armed Services Committee Chair Roger Wicker, Republican of Mississippi, said Tuesday that his committee will investigate the matter. And also he called on the Defense Department's Inspector General to launch a probe. Both of those things sound like very good ideas. Senators say the Senate Intelligence Committee, which is chaired by Republican Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas, will also investigate the security lapse, according to senators on that panel. One Republican senator requested anonymity from the Hill to discuss the matter, said many Republican colleagues are concerned that the security lapse could become a significant political problem if it is not addressed in a credible way. Quote, "It's not going away anytime soon. There's a lot of questions they need to answer and a lot of questions we need to ask," the GOP lawmaker said. Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska said that if senior officials in the Biden administration had made a similar mistake, Republicans in Congress would be blowing their tops. Oh, do you think an actual security scandal to investigate as opposed to one of these made-up ones that Republicans pull out of their rear end year after year? They would have a field day for years over this, and they should. Inadvertently looping a journalist into a text chain discussing military planning was, quote, "really bad," Senator Murkowski said. This is what happens when you don't have your act together. Asked whether Republicans should hold hearings, Murkowski said, quote, "think about what we would do if Biden were president and this came out. We would raise the roof." Republican Senate Majority Leader John Thune on Tuesday encouraged the Armed Services Committee to delve into the issue, telling reporters, quote, "obviously people are asking questions and they deserve answers." Senator Mike Rounds of South Dakota, on the other hand, he's a member of the Intelligence Committee, pathetically said that the Trump administration should take the lead in investigating to what extent the discussion of military strategy may have compromised national security. Sure. Let the Trump administration investigate the Trump administration. Makes total sense, Senator. I'm sure they will get to the bottom of things. Senator Mike Rounds said it should be up to the administration to determine whether laws were broken and whether there should be criminal charges.
So much for congressional oversight.
As noted on yesterday's show, another hearing, in addition to the Senate Intelligence Committee hearing on Tuesday, another hearing was previously scheduled in the U.S. House, in the House Intelligence Committee, on Wednesday, with some of the very same witnesses, including chat group participants, National Intelligence Director Tulsi Gabbard, CIA Director John Ratcliffe, once again, previously being scheduled to give testimony to the House panel on Wednesday, both of whom, by the way, are former Congress members themselves. So they were being confronted by their former House colleagues on Wednesday. Desi Doyen, I know you were up early to monitor the hearings in the House Intelligence Committee. How did it go? Did it go any better for Team Trump in the House than it did on Tuesday in the Senate Intelligence Committee.
No, it did not. It did not go any better. And just to point out that the House Intelligence Committee hearing on Wednesday that was already scheduled was actually supposed to be about the release of the annual National Security Threat Assessment compiled by the nation's intelligence agencies. So there was Gabbard, there was CIA Director Ratcliffe, FBI Director Kash Patel, and two other generals. So committee Democrats focused most of their questions on the signal chat security breach. Republicans mostly ignored it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they focused primarily on fentanyl and immigration and some generic, you know, questions about China and Russia and Iran.
But anything but
pretty
the signal chat.
Now, when the Republicans did mention the signal chat security breach, they downplayed it pretty much as everyone in the Republican side and the Trump White House has been doing as well. They kept trying to shift the focus away from the fact of the breach and the fact that the nation's top national security officials were transmitting detailed military movements and precise timing over an unsecured commercial civilian app. Tulsi Gabbard began the hearing by shifting the focus away from that fact of that security breach, and Republicans subsequently repeated this like a mantra.
There were no sources, methods, locations, or names of targets that were included in that chat.
So Ryan Goodman.
Nothing to worry about.
Right, exactly.
No sources, kept saying names, or targets.
Over and over, that's what they would say. Uh-huh. So Ryan Goodman, who is editor-in-chief of Just Security and himself a former special counsel for the Defense Department, he debunked that notion. He said, quote, "I worked at the Pentagon. If information like this is not classified, nothing is." If Hegseth is going to claim he declassified this information, then he should be shown the door for having done so. Democratic Representative Raj...
It wouldn't be the first time that Pete Hegseth has been shown the door, by
this
the way.
This is true.
Let me help you up to your room. Pete.
Democratic Representative Raja Krishnamurthy of Illinois presented screenshots of the signal chat, which I presume helped to refresh the memories of the participants in chat.
Very
helpful. And as you read, he showed the specific screenshots that you have already read.
The newly released information about the timing and all of that.
That revealed the details of the active military operations, and he called for Hegseth's resignation. And again, just a reminder, under the Espionage Act, none of this has to be actually classified to be illegal.
Just national defense information to people who are not supposed to have it.
Exactly. Like, say, warning that U.S. military personnel are on a mission in enemy airspace, and here's the time when they're going.
Right.
Democratic Representative Joaquin Castro of Texas was having absolutely none of it.
The idea that this information, if it was presented to our committee, would not be classified, y'all know is a lie. That's ridiculous. I've seen things much less sensitive be presented to us with high classification. And to say that it isn't is a lie to the country. There is no way, no way, having sat on this committee for 9 years, that somebody would come in with that information and give us something that says, unclassified, you can walk out of this room with this information and give it to whomever you want. You know, with all respect, you and I worked on the committee at the same time. Tulsi, you and I came in together. I've never had an issue of beef with you. John, you and I are both from Texas. Y'all know that's a lie. It's a lie to the country.
And then Representative Jason Crow, Democrat from Colorado, focused on the fact of the security breach.
I spent my life in service to this country. I deployed 3 times to combat in service to this nation. I learned in that time in service that responsibility is core to leadership. You accept responsibility when things go wrong. You admit mistakes. You set the standard from the very top. It is completely outrageous to me that administration officials come before us today with impunity. No acceptance of responsibility. Excuse after excuse after excuse. Well, we send our men and women downrange to do incredibly difficult, incredibly dangerous things on our behalf. And yet, nobody is willing to come to us and say this was wrong. This was a breach of security and we won't do it again. It is outrageous and it is a leadership failure, and that's why Secretary Hegseth, who undoubtedly transmitted classified, sensitive, operational information via this chain must resign immediately. There can be no fixes. There can be no corrections until there is accountability, and I'm calling on the administration to move forward with accountability. I yield back.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, and it's just it sort of boggles the mind that they even had to say these things. Democratic Representative Christina Houlihan of Pennsylvania, she's a retired Air Force captain. She really pushed back against CIA Director John Ratcliffe, who minutes before had been taking great umbrage at Democrats for not focusing on the rest of the national annual threat assessment. Uh-huh.
Director Ratcliffe, I find it offensive for you to accuse me as a Democrat of not caring about national threats. I very much wanted to talk about those, in fact, had prepared questions in advance of this hearing about those threats, specifically about biosecurity and bioterrorism, but I don't have time to ask those questions because the threat is in the House. The threat is across the dais, and I need to ask these questions. It's my job to ask these questions of you. Because when I served in the military, and I served in classified environments, had this happened to me, I would have walked my resignation in immediately. This is not okay. Communicating these sorts of things in signal is not okay. Targets, times, those kinds of things are absolutely classified, and we all know it. I know it. These people know it. You all know it. And the fact that we're having to have these conversations now means that I can't ask the questions that I need to ask about things like bioterrorism and biosecurity. And so I'd like to put you in check as well, sir, because you can't assume who I am any more than I can assume who you are, sir.
Again, that was Representative Christina Houlihan, former retired Air Force captain, pushing back on this idea that, you know, this is not important enough to focus on.
Incredible.
Yep. Reminding
me of what, again, Pete Hegseth said just this before the story broke on Monday. What Pete Hegseth, defense secretary, drunkard, womanizer, former Fox News host, now defense secretary, what Pete Hegseth said just last Friday.
Under the previous administration, we looked like fools. Not anymore.
Good Lord.
Not anymore. Not anymore, Pete. Well done. Keep up the good work. All right. Speaking of this matter preventing us from talking about other things that also need coverage. And by the way, speaking about Pennsylvania, since you cite Democratic Congresswoman Christina Houlihan there, we have got some election news to get to next for a happy change, including some good news for Democrats and, yes, Pennsylvania, which held special elections on Tuesday, and if time allows, some other election voting news as well. That's straight ahead on today's broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman.
What the public hears on the public airwaves matters. At the broadcast, we do our best to bring you accurate news and analysis on the issues that actually matter, and we do it all independently without corporate or political influence. But we can't do it without you, now more than ever. Please help us stay on your public airwaves by going to bradblog.com/donate to help keep us going. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Why, but for some reason, I've been in the mood lately for music from the 1940s.
Yeah, an interesting time in American
reason.
History.
Yeah, I don't know. Anyway, welcome back to the broadcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Also, some news from Pennsylvania momentarily. I know that many of you are, of course, eagerly awaiting, as am I, next year's midterm elections, providing the first real opportunity to hold this nightmare, fascistic, and entirely incompetent presidential administration and its sycophantic collaborators in Congress to account. But that, of course, is an impossibly long time from now, in November of 2026. But good news for the shorter term, There are a number of elections between here and there, special elections, off-year elections, between now and then, where the voters are also able to express their displeasure with everything going on right now in Washington, D.C. and beyond. To that end, I should mention on next Tuesday, April 1, no fooling, just days away from now, there is a very critical election in the great state of Wisconsin, where majority control is once again on the line at the Wisconsin Supreme Court, with Republicans eagerly hoping to wrestle back control from the liberals, who currently have a 4-3 majority on the high court. That, after some 15 years of far-right Republican control of the court in the Badger State, which they won just a year or two ago back, and which Republicans really, really want to win back to themselves so they can restore their gerrymander to both the state legislature and congressional maps to make it virtually impossible for voters to actually express the will of the people in the purple, if blue-leaning swing state of Wisconsin. The richest billionaire in the world and Donald Trump's co-president Elon Musk is now plowing millions into that Supreme Court race in Wisconsin in favor of the state's former Republican Attorney General Brad Schimmel, who Trump and Elon hope will beat the liberal county judge Susan Crawford in order to take a 4-3 advantage on the high court for Republicans to take that back, allowing them to try and, for example, in addition to gerrymandering the state, again, enact a draconian anti-abortion measure that is still on the books from the 1800s in Wisconsin. Musk is by far the biggest donor in that state Supreme Court race in Wisconsin, and he has once again been paying Republican voters $100 to sign a petition and to get others to sign. You get another $100, apparently, to help harvest those voters for Get Out the Vote efforts, just as he did in the presidential race last year, which is incredibly enough somehow legal, apparently, in hopes of his buying yet another election for Republicans.
Getting out the vote efforts are only legal when Republicans do them, not when Democrats do them. That's the rule.
Well, apparently, I'm not aware of Republicans, Democrats ever paying people to get out the vote, to come out and vote. Here's some money. Anyway, early voter turnout is said to be very, very high in that contest already in advance of the April 1 election day next Tuesday, which we will, of course, be keeping our eyes on. Musk has also now reportedly jumped into the two special U.S. House elections that are being held next Tuesday as well in the great state of Florida to fill the vacated seats of disgraced former congressman, failed Trump Attorney General nominee and alleged child sex trafficker Matt Gaetz to fill his seat and to fill the seat of, at least as of airtime, Trump's current national security advisor, former Congressman Mike Waltz. You've heard of him, who may or may not still be holding his job by the time Election Day actually rolls around next week. We will see, given that he's the one said to be responsible for inviting The Atlantic's Jeffrey Goldberg into the now notorious Signal chat that you may have heard a thing or two about.
Only the best people.
Now, just to manage your expectations down in Florida in those two U.S. House races, they are both very, very red districts in the Sunshine State. You know, the kind of district that elects guys like Matt Gaetz even after the allegations of sex trafficking minor were well known about the guy. They reelected him anyway. So that's where these elections are. And yet, apparently, the richest man in the world still seems to think that the Republican candidates in these races needs his bank account for help there as well, to boost Florida Chief Financial Officer Jimmy Patronis in the 1st Congressional District and State Senator Randy Fine, the Republican running in the 6th District. Spending by Musk's America PAC, which is almost solely funded by Elon Musk in the special election, is said to be minimal so far compared with the millions of dollars that have already been spent down there. But this is a sign that Musk may be paying attention to the contest as he continues to ramp up his political engagement. We won't really know for sure how much he spent until after the election when the final spending reports are released by the Federal Election Commission. But the fact that he's spending it all, as NBC News reports, must be a sign of concern for Republicans. Donald Trump carried the first district in Florida by 37 points last November and the sixth district by 30 points. Last November, just 6 months ago in 2024. Nonetheless, House Republican leaders have been reportedly sounding the alarm about the 6th district, at least, to replace former GOP Rep. Mike Waltz, who resigned in January to become Trump's national security advisor. The Republican candidate, Randy Fine, recently filed a lackluster fundraising report there, significantly trailing his Democratic opponent, Josh Weil, a public school teacher who is running to try to flip that seat somehow from red to blue.
And who probably doesn't have a billionaire backing him.
No, but he is still somehow out fundraising the Republican. In the first district, that's Matt Gaetz's former district, the Republican candidate Jimmy Patronis was also outraised by his Democratic opponent, the delightfully named gun safety advocate Gay Valamont. Valamont outraised the Republican there as well, if not by quite as much. Trump has endorsed both Patronis and Fine, and he and Musk have boosted both Republican candidates in recent Truth Social posts, etc., particularly as Republicans still hold the thinnest of majorities currently in the U.S. House. But those of us fans of democracy don't have to wait until next week to get some good election news. Special elections were held this week on Tuesday in the great Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, just as our bumper music suggested, which might give the folks down in Florida a little bit of inspiration. And because in those races, two of them, in fact, well, the news was not only good for democracy, but for Democrats. First, in the Pennsylvania State House on Tuesday, where Democrats wrested the very narrowest of majority control back from Republicans 2 years ago, but where majority control has sort of bounced back and forth between Democrats since then, between Democrats and and shared power between both parties over the past 2 years. Democrat Dan Gonauer won the Pennsylvania State House seat, vacated by the death of the most recent office holder there, restoring Democrats' narrow majority in the body. Gonauer, a member of a local school board and a police officer, beat Republican Chuck Davis, the president of a local borough council. The result in that race was not a surprise in that it was a very Democratic-leaning House district, House District 35, which voted for Kamala Harris last November with about 58% of the vote. The seat had been vacant since January, however, when then state rep Matt Gergely, also a Democrat, unexpectedly died right after winning re-election. He had been first elected to the state house in 2023 in a special election to succeed the man who is now the state's Democratic lieutenant governor. And then he was re-elected to a full term last November without opposition. But his death turned the Democrats' 102 to 101 seat majority, told you it was a thin majority, to an even split with Republicans. But Gonauer's victory will now return the body to the former composition. Democrats won that majority in the state house for the first time in a decade back in 22 and kept it exactly intact in November until Gergely's death. The DNC signaled its strong interest in securing that seat with the newly elected DNC chair, Ken Martin, starting a national tour in Gonauer's hometown and campaigned with him in February. Martin said in a statement that Gonauer's win allows Pennsylvania Democrats to better stand up to Donald Trump and defend Pennsylvania Democratic Governor Josh Shapiro from Republican legislators pushing constitutional amendments to try to strip him of power. In his statement, Martin said, quote, "Building the Democratic Party back begins in the states and down ballot wins like Rep-elect Gonauer's office, a powerful rebuke of Donald Trump and Elon Musk's MAGA agenda. But that was not even the best news for Democrats out of Keystone State on Tuesday night. Democrat James Andrew Malone very narrowly, reportedly won a special election for a Pennsylvania State Senate seat in Republican-leaning suburbs and farming communities, scoring an upset in a district that a Democrat has not represented in the chamber for 136 years.
Wow.
The AP called the very narrow race Wednesday after receiving information from county officials that there were fewer ballots left to be counted than the margin in the very tight race. Malone's Republican opponent, Josh Parsons, conceded Wednesday after reportedly losing by just a few hundred votes out of more than 50,000 cast.
Don't ever let anyone tell you elections don't matter and voting doesn't matter.
According to excellent reporting from the local Lancaster Online's Jackson White, Malone said, "This is wonderful. We started from the bottom. In fact, the 36th district has not had a Democratic state senator since it moved from Philadelphia to Lancaster County in 1979, though it has been much longer since this specific area has been represented by a Democrat, more than 100 years. Governor Josh Shapiro celebrated Malone's apparent win on social media, saying, quote, "Tonight in Lancaster County, Pennsylvanians rejected a candidate who embraced the extremism and division coming out of D.C. In a district carried comfortably by Donald Trump just a few months ago, they chose a better way forward, an embrace of competence, common sense, and a desire to bring people together." Stephen Medvick, a political science professor at Franklin and Marshall College, posted on social media Tuesday night, quote, "Democrats just flipped a seat in a Trump plus 15 state Senate district in Lancaster County. This," he said, "is stunning." Just 4 months ago, as Lancaster Online reports, voters in the same district gave Trump a resounding win, making Malone's results Tuesday a sign of how local Democrats are seizing on national politics to make gains in bright red districts. Nearly every measurable variable favored Parsons, the Republican, when polls opened at 7 a.m. on Tuesday, reports Jackson White. A majority of registered voters in the 36th district are Republicans. Parsons also raised more money than the Democrat Malone, and many of Pennsylvania's top Republicans had backed Parsons. But Democratic Party organizers had hoped that discontent with Trump's actions in the first months of his second White House term could help build momentum for Malone, and apparently it did. Registered Democrats, their lead in early absentee ballot returns last week was an early sign for some that Malone could, in fact, put up a fight in the historically red district. Those returns attracted concerns from prominent Republicans. White reports, like, yes, in fact, Elon Musk, who commented, ! Early Friday morning on a post on his social media site, retweeting it from a local GOP activist who said the party was losing that race. As Jackson White reported over the weekend, the Democrat Malone said on Saturday that his campaign volunteers had heard concerns from thousands of voters about Musk's work with the Trump administration to reshape the federal government, which he said had led to, quote, benefits for veterans, retirees, and students being cut so Elon Musk can get a tax cut. Apparently, running against Elon Musk works. "Josh Parsons might be okay with that," said Malone, "but I am not." On Tuesday, he said over the weekend, you'll get to make the choice between more Musk or Lancaster values. And apparently voters did make that choice against Musk. Malone told AP today that the chaos around Trump's first 2 months helped him. He said, quote, "If President Trump were trying to accomplish his agenda in a very methodical and cohesive and by-the-book way, we wouldn't have had as much vitriol as we do right now." But he's chosen to do it the way that he does everything, right? Said Malone. Throw a brick in the basket, see what comes out. Malone is a computer application designer. He's mayor of the tiny East Petersburg town with a population of about 4,500. One of the top Democrats in the Senate said Malone's victory shows the National Party the value of talking about protecting Social Security and health care access amid what he sees as the chaos and pain that the Trump administration is bringing. Quote, as much anger that people have, they have anxiety too, said Senator Vince Hughes of Philadelphia. And last night's election sends a message that people are going to respond. And so far, anyway, in special elections, they have responded. This is, in fact, the second Democratic legislative flip so far this year, and the year is young. In 25, after a red state Senate seat in Iowa flipped earlier this year. Last month, you'll remember, Democrats pulled off a stunning upset in the Buckeye state of Iowa when they flipped the state Senate seat in a district where Donald Trump had won by 21 points just months earlier in 2024. So, good news for Democrats. What will that mean for next Tuesday's Supreme Court election in Wisconsin and those two U.S. House special elections in Florida and municipal elections elsewhere? Well, we will see. The odds, as I noted, are certainly stacked against Democrats in Florida, but so were they in Pennsylvania and Iowa. And Musk knows that he will likely catch a blame for those losses. So, yes, Republicans are at the very least, running scared. We'll see what they do. We'll see what voters do, because in the end, it is supposed to be up to us. I say supposed to be, which is why Republicans work so hard to try and prevent, well, certain voters from being able to vote at all. And that is the main reason, of course, that Donald Trump issued an executive order on Tuesday night that was misreported by many mainstream outlets to suggest that Trump was mandating proof of citizenship for all voters, which is a power that the president simply does not have, as most power over elections is held by the states and even counties, with some of that power relegated to the U.S. Congress, but not to the president, despite Trump pretending otherwise. With his largely performative executive order on Tuesday night that you might have heard of, that will definitely be challenged largely from top to bottom by democracy and voting advocates in court almost immediately. As CNN reported, President Donald Trump signed an executive order Tuesday seeking to boost proof of citizenship requirements for voter registration, which critics say could disenfranchise millions of poor and older voters who do not have easy access to citizenship documents like passports or birth certificates. Republican lawmakers have long sought to require such documents for voter registration, but a major hurdle has been a Supreme Court ruling mandating that states accept, at least for federal elections, the generic voter registration form that is offered by the U.S. Elections Assistance Commission, which currently does not require documents proving citizenship. Trump's order, however, directs the EAC to add that requirement and to withhold election funding from states that do not enforce the requirement for voters who use the federal registration form. But the EAC is currently made up of two Democratic and two Republican appointees, and Trump does not have the power to tell them what to do. As election law professor Rick Hassan noted in his response to Trump's executive order on Tuesday night, which he described as, quote, an executive power grab that, if it could survive the inevitable judicial challenge, would severely shift power over federal elections into the hands of the presidency. Writes Hassan, after the disputed 2000 election, when Congress passed the Help America Vote Act, it set up an independent, bipartisan agency called the U.S. Election Assistance Commission, EAC, to do certain things like certifying voting equipment and doling out funds to states for voting technology upgrades. Trump's order in a number of places purports to direct the EAC to do certain things. He does not have that power, notes Rick Hassan, unless the courts accept some aggressive version of the unitary executive theory that's been percolating in other cases. Yeah, well, that's a big unless. That theory says that Donald Trump controls every executive branch office, no matter how it's been set up, even if it's been set up to keep it independent of the White House. But notes Hassan, if president can control the EAC, it could direct the agency to do all kinds of things that could benefit the president's party. It would flout the bipartisan balanced approach of the EAC as originally imagined by Congress. Hassan notes that if the EAC actually did what Trump is demanding, it would disenfranchise millions of voters. He says right now, under the National Voter Registration Act, any eligible voter can register to vote in any state using that federal form that requires the information Congress demanded sufficient to establish eligibility, including citizenship, for voting. Trump's executive order would direct the EAC to change the federal form to require documentary proof of citizenship for voting. Even though Congress did not set it up that way, that would prevent only a tiny amount of non-citizen voter registration, but it would stop millions of eligible voters who do not have access, easy access to documents like passports, keep them from registering to vote. The aim here, he writes, is voter suppression, pure and simple. Even if the EAC has the power to change this form rather than Congress, the question is whether the president would have the power to order it. There's some other stuff in this order regarding mail ballots being returned by Election Day, even if they're postmarked by Election Day, changes to voting systems. Most of that, Donald Trump does not have the power to order. All of it, we'll have to wait for another day on this show, however, for me to get into. But we'll keep it for a slow news day.
If any ever occur.
But suffice to say, again, Trump does not have the power that he is pretending that he has. And anyone who reports on this executive order without pointing that out should lose their journalism license. If there was such a thing, which thankfully there is not. All right, we got to get out. My thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's show or any other, download it anytime for free at bradblog.com. That is free for all, thanks to those of you who hit a donate button and help us stay on your public airwaves. Drop me email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. And on the social medias, especially Blue Sky, you will find me at The Brad Blog. We'll see you there. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
Pennsylvania 6-5000.
You're listening to The Bradcast. We are 100%. Listener-supported, thanks to listeners like you who stop by bradblog.com/donate.